Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikovei Tachvei, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The top stories the Arab League says. Israeli plan to double the settler population in the occupied Golan Heights is a flagrant violation of international law. The United States is seeing its highest daily rise in COVID cases as the battle to keep Omicron in check goes on. China accuses the U.S. of irresponsible and unsafe conduct over close encounters of American satellites with its space station. Welcome to the program. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas and the Arab League have condemned Israel's latest settler population plans in the occupied Golan Heights. During our news review program, we discussed that issue with our guests.
Now, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams Israel's latest settlement plans in occupied Golan Heights as a new act of hostility against the Arab people. A Hamas spokesperson denounced the plans as a violation of international law, which further exposes the regime's expansionist policy. Hazem Qasem, however, said Israel will never succeed in changing the Arab identity of occupied territories. Earlier, the Arab League warned Israel over its settlement plans in Occupy Golan Heights. Organization said Israel must stop its attempts to change the demographic makeup and legal status of the territory. Regime is planning to double the number of Israeli settlers in Golan by building thousands of new units there. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Mike Harris, editor at Veterans Today, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona, and Mr. Bruce Katz, co-president at Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joining us from Montreal. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in sunny Phoenix, Arizona with you, Mr. Harris. Hope you're safe and doing well. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, sir. Your initial thoughts about what's taking place? We've seen it a lot in the occupied territories on this side. Now we're looking at Syrian soil. Your thoughts on this expansionist policy of the Israeli regime and how it just basically stands in the face of international law and doesn't care one bit about it?
Well, that's I concur. Israel does not care one bit about international law. The only thing Israel cares about is Israel. And they have been the invaders into Palestine since 1947, Israel came into being. And they haven't stopped their expansionist policies ever. And what Israel needs is a good spanking. And I really would hope that the Syrian Arab Army is capable of responding in force to the Israeli invasion of their sovereign territory. This whole issue with the Golan Heights has been going on for too long. Israel is the aggressor in this, has been the aggressor in the Middle East, as I said, since 1947 when they were created. They have bad intentions. They're not good people. The settlers need to be forcibly removed by whatever means necessary from the Golan Heights, and this territory needs to be restored to Syria, who is the its rightful Syrian sovereign territory.
Thank you, Mr. Mike Harris. Mr. Bruce Katz, welcome to the program. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Montreal. Happy holidays, Mr. Katz. Your thoughts, it didn't help when Mike Pompeo went out there in the last Washington administration and visited and called it Israeli territory, did it? When international law completely says something different.
Well, I think that regardless of what Pompeo's visit or what he had to say, Israel has no respect whatsoever for the rule of law. That is a constant. That's been a constant since 1948. A Hamas spokesman hit the nail on the head when he referred to the fact that Israel can act with impunity because countries like the United States, and I might add Canada, to the shame of the Trudeau government and other Western so-called democracies, provide Israel with that impunity, because despite one crime enacted upon another, there is no talk of sanctions. There is no real movement among governments to divest from Israel. So Israel knows that it can get the backing of Western governments and, unfortunately, a certain number of Arab regimes that have normalized with Israel to their shame and dishonor. And this is what stokes the fires of Israeli apartheid and its brutal and illegal occupation of Palestinian territories and of the Syrian Golan Heights. The rule of law simply doesn't count for Israel.
And Mr. Mike Harris, what kind of precedent is it for the West to continue to support Tel Aviv, the regime there, as it attempts and annexes parts of a sovereign country?
Well, it doesn't speak well of Israel. What the Arab and Muslim countries need to do is to form a NATO-type organization, that if Israel attacks one, they attack all, and that all of them will respond in force to Israel. They should stop Israeli access to their airspace where they can't fly over. They should embargo the Mediterranean so that Israel can't get anything in or out of their ports. And they should really make Israel pay a price for this, because Israel has gotten away with this for way, way too long. The U.S., all of us in the U.S. know that Israel is a liability, not an asset. The only reason that the U.S. still supports Israel is because of the strong Jewish influence in United States politics. APAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, requires politicians to sign a pledge to support Israel, and if they don't, they will fund their opponent. So our democracy is for sale for money, and without the Jewish-Israeli money funding candidates, you would have a very, very different foreign policy. Shame on Mike Pompeo. Shame on Donald Trump for supporting the move to annex the Golan Heights and recognize Jerusalem as the capital. Israel, any agreement that anyone reaches with Israel is not worth the paper it's written on. They are liars, they are cheats, they are murderers. And it's time that the world started calling them out for what they are. These are not good people. These are evil people. And they need to be dealt with harshly. And the world is fed up with Israel and their adventurism, their expansionism, and their outright cruelty to the Arabic people and the Muslim people around the world.
J. Gentlemen, thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. Happy holidays to both of you. Thank you for taking time joining us here on News Review Program. Mr. Mike Harris, editor at Veterans Today, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona, and Mr. Bruce Katz, co-president at Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joining us from Montreal. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review Program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
As for the other stories for now, the coronavirus is again spreading fast in the United States, setting a new record high as the Omicron strain quickly takes hold throughout the country. There have been more than 441,000 infections in a single day, up from a daily record of 294,000 cases last winter, before vaccines became widely available. The steep rise has led to long lines at testing sites and sold-out rapid tests at many stores. The Christmas holidays shuttered testing places, also leading to a spike in demand. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, however, says the daily caseload is likely to overestimate due to lagging state reporting. It says the count will become more stable after the new year. The COVID-19 infections hit record highs in European countries as well, amid growing concerns over the fast spread of the Omicron variant. France has reported nearly 180,000 new cases, Europe's highest single-day tally. The country will implement new restrictions from January the 3rd. In Britain, officials logged over 129,000 new infections, excluding cases in Scotland and Northern Ireland. The government, however, says it does not plan any curves for England before the new year. Daily infections also hit a record high in Italy, where outdoor public events and parties are banned until the new year. Germany and Finland have also tightened COVID curves. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is warning about the very high risk of Omicron strain, given its growth advantage over the previous dominant variant, Delta. China condemns the U.S. for close encounters of American satellites with its space station, calling it irresponsible and unsafe. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says the U.S. is posing a serious threat to the lives and safety of astronauts by turning a blind eye to its international obligations and responsibilities. Earlier, Beijing submitted a note to the United Nations holding Washington responsible under the Outer Space Treaty for the conduct of all U.S. entities, including private ones. The United States has not directly responded to China's criticism, but says it has encouraged all countries with space programs to be responsible actors. Beijing says its Tiangong space station has had to maneuver twice in the past year to avoid collision with American satellites. And now the parents of a Chilean immigrant teenager shot dead by U.S. police are calling for justice. Valentina Orellana Peralta was killed last Thursday during a chaotic police operation in a department store in California. She was hiding in a changing room when a police officer responding to an attack fired a bullet that struck her chest. Valentina's father says the officers involved in her killing are criminals and must be jailed. Los Angeles police say the officer is now on paid administrative leave and that a complete and transparent investigation will be conducted. U.S. police are known to readily use force to confront criminal suspects. Last year alone, they have shot and killed more than 900 people. Well, California is not the only U.S. state shocked by a tragic shooting. Colorado, too, is still reeling a day after a gunman killed five people there. Three other people, including a police officer, were wounded in the shooting spree that took place across four locations in the cities of Denver and Lakewood. Police finally shot dead the suspect after an exchange of fire in a shooting in a shopping center. The gunman's incentive is so far unknown. Many believe the easy access to firearms and the loose regulations should be blamed for the rampant gun violence in America. 2021 was an eventful year for Europe. Apart from dealing with the pandemic and the socioeconomic challenges it caused, the continent grappled with other problems, including those related to its internal politics. The following report brings you some of the major developments in Europe in 2021.
Europe grappled with many issues during the year 2021. Developments happening in the aftermath of the UK's exit from the European Union a year earlier were among those issues. Britain remained at odds with the EU over post-Brexit trade in Northern Ireland, while being involved in a dispute with Spain over Gibraltar. The UK was also at loggerheads with France over post-Brexit rights for their fishermen. A supply chain crisis was another issue that resulted in high commodity prices across Europe. Officials blamed the crisis on the pandemic, rising demands, and shortage of workers. But many industry leaders pointed the finger at politicians and their policies, including tax hikes. The pandemic also led to social unrest in Europe, where people in many countries were angry at restrictions, mandatory vaccines, and health passes. They accused their governments of mismanagement. In France, anger also boiled over police brutality, as well as President Emmanuel Macron's economic policies, blamed for existing inequality. Those policies brought yellow vest protesters to the streets after months-long pause over the COVID pandemic. The Belarus-European Union border crisis was another highlight. It all began in July after thousands of migrants flocked to Belarus's border with three EU member states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Poland. But they were pushed back, arrested, and even beaten by the three countries' border guards. Rights groups and activists slammed the EU for violating the rights of the migrants, as they remained stranded in difficult conditions. Another migrant crisis also unfolded in November, when dozens of migrants lost their lives after the boat capsized in the English Channel. They were using the waterway to reach Britain from France. The tragedy also fueled a dispute between Paris and London, each blaming the other for not doing enough to address the migrant issue. Also in 2021, the EU faced a rebellion from two of its member states, Poland and Hungary. The two, among other things, were opposed to an EU law that says the bloc's law trumps national decision-making in each member state. In November, the two countries vetoed the EU's long-term budget and coronavirus rescue plan. The EU, in response, blocked billions of dollars in economic aid. The EU was also at odds with Russia. Tensions increased to the highest level since the end of the Cold War over Ukraine. The bloc accused Moscow of planning an attack on its neighbor, a charge the Kremlin denied. Moscow in turn accused NATO of using Ukraine as a pretext to increase its military presence on Russian borders to encircle the country. In July, a joint media investigation uncovered a worldwide network of wiretaps targeting politicians, journalists, and activists. They were spied on with the help of the Pegasus spyware that was designated by the Israeli company NSO Group. Some of the victims include European Council President Charles Michel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and several of his cabinet ministers. The scandal sparked a crisis in Israeli-European ties, with France freezing diplomatic and intelligence cooperation with Tel Aviv. The EU also condemned the regime's spying. And on December 8, Europe saw one of its long-serving leaders quit power. Angela Merkel stepped down as German Chancellor after 16 years in office, following elections held in September. Analysts say Merkel's departure is expected to change the course of Europe's biggest economy, and that her absence will leave a substantial leadership gap in the continent. All in all, 2021 was a tough year for Europe, as it faced many challenges on all fronts. European leaders seem to have a tough time ahead, as they should find solutions to these challenges to prevent further crises in their continent.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was the most loved and popular Iranian commander for the last decade. He was the symbol of a struggle against oppressors and support for the oppressed. His jihad aimed at a lofty goal, namely, dignity of Islam and saving the oppressed from the yoke of oppressors. General Soleimani's heritage is valor, resistance, inexhaustibility, and self-sacrifice in the way of God. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said in part of his message on the occasion of Qasem Soleimani's martyrdom, "Martyr Soleimani is the international figure of resistance, and all enthusiasts of resistance are avengers of his blood." Resistance is the salvaging way in the face of the domineering system. This doctrine has stemmed from the Quran, and it was highly stressed in the words of Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khamenei, too, has emphasized on the issue as the only method to rescue the Islamic nations. He says, "The Iranian nation did a great job. In a world which is based on the power, bullying, and pillaging of the powerful and bullies, and the downtrodden nations in many regions of the world are always under the pressure of these bullies, a creature and an identity has taken its head high and explicitly, without consideration, and quite bravely negated this wrong movement of the world, which is the movement of domineering. And we call it as the domineering system. This is the Iranian nation's job. The Iranian nation has negated the domineering system, which is based on the domineering and the domineered. The leader of the Islamic Revolution calls resistance as a religious and human issue. In his view, resistance has various aspects. The most important aspect, however, is trusting God and His promises in the Quran. He points out, resistance is not possible except in the light of faith in God, relying and trust in the divine promises. Almighty God has promised in the Noble Quran and said emphatically, "And surely God will assist those who assist Him." He has promised assistance with emphasis, and this promise will materialize. If we reform ourselves and look at the divine promises optimistically rather than pessimistically, we will triumph. In view of Ayatollah Khamenei, patience and steadfastness are two other aspects of resistance. He believes that God ordered the Prophet from the very beginning of his mission to have patience and perseverance. God told the Prophet in Ayah 7 of Surah Al-Muddathir, "And be patient for the sake of your Lord." He also ordered Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in Ayah 10 of Surah Al-Muzammil, "And be patient over what they say." And in Ayah 112 of Surah Hud, however, God orders the Prophet to be resistant along with the faithful. He says, "So be steadfast, just as you have been commanded, and whoever has turned to Allah with you." It is noteworthy that Imam Khomeini used to refer to this ayah as the roadmap for the faithful vis-a-vis the enemies. Ayatollah Khamenei, as the true disciple of Imam Khomeini, believes that patience and steadfastness do not mean indolence and passivity. They rather mean moving and making effort. He says, "Patience does not mean sitting idly and expecting the results and events. Patience means standing, resisting, not changing one's correct and exact calculations with the deception of the enemy. Patience means pursuit of the goals which we have designed for ourselves. Patience means moving and continuing with spirit. This is the meaning of patience. Ayatollah Khamenei points to insight and recognition of enemy as other elements of resistance. He says, care should be taken so that one does not make a mistake in recognition of the right way. To be able to find a way in the obfuscation of seditions and to know what the right way. This is the insight. He says elsewhere, if these two elements, including insight and patience, exist among a nation, the enemy cannot do anything and cannot inflict any damage and will not attain any success in confronting and countering the Islamic system. The leader maintains that insight and recognition of the enemy are more important for officials than the people. He explains, nations are always ready for resistance. What is important are the leaders. We have seen in the recent years that wherever the nations moved, showed their resolve and willpower, they achieved results. As there were no leaders who can administer them properly, distinguish the goal properly, and draw up the way in front of the people properly, they failed. The Iranian nation, with the blessing of Imam Khomeini, covered the way properly and took the movement properly, as they had a mighty, aware, and resolute leader who trusted in God and relied in the divine promises. Indefatigable effort is another element of resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. He says, once the Islamic Republic was a thin sapling, today it is a pure, robust, and strong tree, which no storm can root it out. Horrendous events occurred, but this nation managed to save itself in these horrendous events and move forward. In the events like the eight-year war, the Iranian nation stood strongly and brought the enemies to their knees. And in spite of the enemy, they did not surrender and was not brought to its knees and expanded the domain of its might and dignity. Jihad is one of the main elements of resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that jihad is one of the gates of paradise which Allah has opened to his special servants. One of these valiant mujahids of the resistance front was Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani, who received his reward through martyrdom. Ayatollah Khamenei says, Haj Qasim had been exposed to martyrdom 100 times. This was not the first time, but he was scared of nothing in the way of God, fulfilling the duty and jihad in the way of God. He feared neither the enemy nor the words of such and such, nor still the endurance of labor. Dear listeners, Martyr Soleimani has turned into the code name of resistance and jihad against oppression and sedition.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the beginning of April 2011, the Syrian army was ordered to intervene after an increase in armed attacks on security forces in the city of Daraa. But it's safe to say that ordering the army to the streets was a hasty decision, because the intervention of military forces not only did not improve the situation, but also complicated it. What actually happened was the success of the opposition in trying to provoke the people in other parts of Syria and gaining international support. The intervention of the army was good media propaganda to achieve this goal, and the popular networks in the Arab world would regularly broadcast images of heavy weapons entering the cities. And people in contact with these networks would say that armed forces were shooting at the people. Syrian opposition forces.
Part 2.
As the Syrian army was making its efforts to control the crisis, Bashar Assad continued with political reforms. One of the steps he took was issuing a general amnesty to political prisoners. Many of the people who were arrested during and even before the protests were released from prisons. Some of the released prisoners were Salafis who had fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and were in prison because of their membership in terrorist groups. But after their release, many of these people formed extremist Islamist groups against Assad and became senior members of these groups. The release of the Takfiri prisoners and their role in forming Takfiri groups was so effective that later on, opponents of Bashar Assad accused him of intentionally freeing them. They believed the motive behind the release of the Takfiri prisoners was that by forming Takfiri groups, they could take over the initiative from the secular and moderate opponents of the government. Bashar Assad ordered the release of the prisoners to lessen the attacks of Salafi scholars inside and outside of Syria. And it was obvious that he had no idea of the role they would play in the developments of Syria. At the time, Islamist groups had still not entered the battles in Syria, and opposition forces were trying their best to prevent the conflict from taking on an Islamist position. They believed that talk of the emergence of Islamist leanings in the future Syrian government would scare the West, and they would not allow the formation of an Islamist state which neighbored Israel. The Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, as the most powerful political opposition movement at the time, emphasized on different occasions that it did not seek to establish an Islamic government in Syria. 5 months after the beginning of the protests, on August the 9th of 2011, the King of Saudi Arabia issued a statement which strongly condemned the Syrian government. This statement was the beginning of serious political pressure on Bashar Assad. After this statement, the Saudi ambassador left Damascus, and following that, many countries cut off ties with Syria. At the height of diplomatic pressures on Syria's government, an incident took place in the Arab world which had an effect on Syria's crisis. Libya's revolutionary forces were able to enter the city of Tripoli and brutally killed Muammar Gaddafi. The downfall and death of Gaddafi raised the spirits of the Syrian protesters, who repeatedly promised the same fate for Bashar Assad if he did not step down. The Arab League had a decisive role in the downfall of Gaddafi. It condemned the actions of the Libyan government and army in response to the protests, and had asked the Security Council to stop Gaddafi's actions. The Security Council issued a resolution giving NATO permission to create a no-fly zone over Libya.
intervention of NATO planes changed the balance of power in favor of the opposition. The Libyan army, which had already been weakened because it had delivered its strategic weapons to the West in an attempt to build confidence, was defeated. The cooperation of the Arab League and the Security Council caused the downfall of Gaddafi's rule in less than 6 months. Now the Arab League wanted to use the same successful formula against Bashar Assad. The Arab League suspended Syria's membership and announced that it will send an observer group to Syria and make its final decision based on the group's report. The Arab League appointed a Sudanese general named Mohammed Addabi as the head of the Arab Observer Group in Syria. Aside from being active in Sudan's military, Mohammed Addabi also had experience in diplomatic efforts, and after retiring from the military, he was Sudan's ambassador to Qatar for years. Mohammed Addabi and his group, which numbers 166, entered Syria on December the 22nd, 2011. During several weeks, they visited different cities which were the scene of clashes. A month later, on the 21st of January 2012, Mohammed Addabi turned in his report on the situation in Syria to the Secretary General of the Arab League, Nabil El Arabi. But despite expectations, Mohammed Dabi's report was in favor of the Syrian government and told of the attacks of the armed opposition against Syrian forces. In his report, Dabi had emphasized that the Syrian army only targets positions which the armed groups use to attack them, and there was no intention in killing civilians.
Vladimir Putin and former president, current prime minister Medvedev, both of them have noted publicly what a tremendous mistake and blunder of historical proportions it was for Russia and China not to veto UN Security Council Resolution 1973 in Libya. And I think they took this situation in Syria as a, let's call it a second chance, an attempt to redeem themselves.
Before the Russian and Chinese veto of the Security Council resolution, different groups which opposed Bashar Assad were trying to hide their religious leanings. But when it became obvious that the Security Council would not allow NATO's direct involvement in Syria, Bashar Assad's opponents decided to bring down the government by strengthening armed groups and providing them with more weapons. Even though until then, the Free Syrian Army was still the most powerful armed group in Syria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, which were Bashar Assad's most prominent opponents, decided to strengthen Salafi groups. These Salafi groups were more battle-hardened than the Free Syrian Army because of their beliefs and the experience of their participation in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Prominent Salafi groups, which became the stars of the Syrian crisis in 2012, had only been formed a few months before the end of 2011. But after Saudi Arabia and Qatar changed their policies, they were able to strengthen themselves with the support of these countries. The most prominent Salafi group, which announced its formation only 2 weeks after the veto of the Security Council's resolution, was the Front of the Supporters of the People of the Levant, Syria, or the Nusra Front. The leader of this group was a 31-year-old named Abu Muhammad Julani. Based on unconfirmed reports in 2013, his real name was Ahmad Hussein Ashara, and he was born in 1981 in the village of Ash-Shuhayl in the Deir ez-Zor district. His father was a driver for a department in the Syrian army. In 2003, when he was in his second year of college, studying to become a doctor at Damascus University, he left his studies and went to Iraq to fight against U.S. forces and joined Al-Qaeda. In 2006, after the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Julani left Iraq for a short time and went to Lebanon and started to train the Junta Sham. But after a while, he went back to Iraq to cooperate with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the successor of Zarqawi. but the U.S. military arrested him and he was in Buqqa prison until 2008. After he was released from prison, Abu Bakr Baghdadi put him in charge of al-Qaeda's operations in Mosul. A month and a half after the beginning of the protests in Syria, Osama bin Laden was killed by American commandos in Pakistan, and Ayman al-Zawahiri took over the leadership of al-Qaeda. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi did not accept a new leadership, and the conflict between him and Ayman al-Zawahiri grew. The conflict became worse when Ayman al-Zawahiri pledged allegiance with Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. When the conflict was still not public, Ayman al-Zawahiri called on all fighters across the world to prepare for jihad in Syria. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi took a stance against the leader of al-Qaeda and announced that jihad in Syria was forbidden. Abu Muhammad Julani and his companions began their operations in the Deir ez-Zor region in the last month of 2011. But the official formation of Nusra Front was in January 2012, and it was accompanied with a number of bombing operations in Damascus. Later on, the group released a number of hostages it had taken with the mediation of the head of Qatar's security apparatus, which showed that not only did a number of commanders, but the entire Qatari government was in direct contact with this group. The next three Salafi jihadi groups, which were effective along with the Nusra Front in 2012, were established by three friends. These three were inmates at Sadnaya military prison near Damascus, accused of having ties with terrorist groups. The most famous one was Zahran Alush. He was the son of a famous Syrian Salafi named Sheikh Abdullah Alush. After learning the basics of religious studies from his father, he went to Saudi Arabia and attended the classes of the most prominent Salafi scholars at the Islamic University of Medina, such as Sheikh Abdullah bin Baz. After Alush returned to Syria, he began religious and promotional activities. At the end of 2009, Zahran Alush was arrested by Syrian security forces because of his ties with terrorist groups. But after a year and a half, he was released from prison after a general amnesty was issued. After being released from prison, Alush and a number of like-minded people set up a group called Sariat al-Islam in the city of Douma. In Arabic, Sariyah is what the smallest military unit is called. But Zahran Alush was quickly able to increase his forces. He was able to attract smaller groups which were not able to generate a lot of financial and logistical support from foreigners.
And I am confident, you know.
Because of Zahran Alush's history with Saudi Arabia, the group he commanded was supported by Bandar bin Sultan, the then head of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency.
Well, it has funded various rebel groups, no question. And that's the way the Saudis have proceeded. They have not committed their own forces, but they have provided arms, money, ammunition to the rebel groups that they had confidence in.
The third prominent Salafi group, which was formed at the end of 2011 in Syria, was Ahrar al-Sham, which was established by another one of the released prisoners of Sadnaya military prison. His name was Hassan Aboud. He was born in the city of Hama. He became acquainted with Salafi groups when he was studying English in the city of Aleppo. And he was in prison because of his activities within these groups. After his release from prison, he set up a battalion named Ahrar al-Sham with another group of released prisoners in the Hama region. In the beginning of 2012, messengers from Ayman al-Zawahiri supported this group. With the interference of al-Qaeda, the Islamic Fajr movement and other smaller movements joined the group, and Ahrar al-Sham officially began its activities. The movement was very capable because it was well-equipped and well-resourced. It was able to carry out many operations against the Syrian army.
During this period, Abu Khalid Suri was in charge of planning the organizational chart and training of the Ahrar al-Sham movement. Abu Khalid Suri was a close acquaintance of Osama bin Laden and among the people trusted by Ayman al-Zawahiri. He had fought in the wars in Chechnya, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and because of his experience, he was respected by the Leadership Council of Ahrar al-Sham. With the establishment and expansion of these Salafi groups, little by little, support for secular groups decreased, and those who were supposed to take over power in Syria were now being ignored by the countries that used to support them because of the veto of the Security Council's resolution. The amount of support for Islamist groups was so great that even the Free Syrian Army thought of forming Salafi armed groups. Even though the group introduced itself as a secular group without ethnic and religious leanings, from this period on, it set up Salafi Islamist battalions to be able to get a share of the money that was coming in from the countries of the Persian Gulf region. The most important Islamist group affiliated with the Syrian army was the Tawhid Brigade, which was made up of 29 small Islamist groups, and it was established in the Aleppo region. The commander of the Tawhid Brigade was Abdul Qadir Saleh. After the establishment of these groups, a wave of volunteers from different parts of the world went to Syria. During this process, Salafi scholars had a determining role in encountering young Sunnis to go to Syria. The interesting part was the change in the position that prominent scholars took when it came to Bashar Assad. For example, Sheikh Yusuf Abdullah al-Kardawi, who was the chairman of the International Union of Muslim Scholars, had visited Syria many times before the crisis began and was a supporter of Bashar Assad. But after the political change in Qatar when it came to Syria, Sheikh Kardawi suddenly changed his position. Many of the people who would travel to Syria for jihad were controlled by the security services of their countries because of the way they thought and communicated, but these security systems did not prevent them from going to Syria. Even in some European countries, some mosques had turned into headquarters to organize and send young people to Syria. The security forces in these countries did not prevent these people from traveling to Syria. It seemed they were following a policy that the exit of these people from their country would improve their own national security. Some European media organizations would even broadcast reports that showed the humanitarian efforts of groups affiliated to Al-Qaeda. Foreign fighters would go to Turkey and Lebanon and from there be transferred into Syria. The Turkish government had given the Salafi groups free passage and did not create any obstacles in their transfer via unofficial border passages. But in Lebanon, things were a bit different. The Lebanese government had announced its neutrality in the Syrian crisis, but from the very beginning, the political group, the March 14 Alliance, began to actively support armed opposition groups in Syria. At the time, among the political parties of the March 14 Alliance, the Future Movement, led by Saad Hariri, would provide the most help to the opposition groups in Syria. Even though the Future Movement constantly insisted that its support for armed groups in Syria was merely spiritual in nature, the Daily Al-Akhbar printed a recording of a call by a Future Movement PM named Okab Sagar, which showed that this political group provides a part of the weapons that Salafi groups use in Syria. A few days later, during a press conference, Okab Sagar attacked those who had reported the conversation and said the movement is only sending humanitarian aid to Syria. Later on, unarmed opponents of Bashar Assad revealed that the Future Movement had made suggestions to them that in exchange for money and weapons, they take up arms against Bashar Assad's government.
the limelight. Even if highly contagious COVID-19 variant maximizes its potential, laws of biochemistry show the virus cannot keep improving indefinitely. We're prepared for an article written by Ben Krishna, a postdoctoral researcher, immunology and virology, University of Cambridge. The piece is titled, Why Omicron May Be the Final Variant of Concern. The article has been published by the Asia Times. It is controversial whether viruses are alive, but like all living things, they do evolve. This fact has become abundantly clear during the pandemic, as new variants of concern have emerged every few months. Some of these variants have been better at spreading from person to person, eventually becoming dominant as they outcompete slower versions of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. This improved spreading ability has been ascribed to mutations in the spike protein. The mushroom-shaped projections on the surface of the virus that allow it to bind more strongly to ACE2 receptors in the human body. ACE2 are receptors on the surface of our cells, such as those that line our airways, that the virus attaches to in order to gain entry and start replicating. These mutations allowed the Alpha variant and then the Delta variant to become globally dominant. And scientists expect the same thing to happen with the Omicron variant. However, the virus cannot improve indefinitely. The laws of biochemistry mean that the virus will eventually evolve a spike protein that binds to ACE2 as strongly as possible. By that point, the ability of SARS-CoV-2 to spread between people will not be limited by how well the virus can stick to the outside of cells. Other factors will limit viral spread, such as how fast the genome can replicate, how quickly the virus can enter the cell via the protein TMPRSS2, and how much virus an infected human can shed. In principle, all of these should eventually evolve to peak performance. Has the Omicron variant reached this peak? There is no good reason to assume that it has. So-called gain-of-function studies, which look at what mutations SARS-CoV-2 needs to spread more efficiently, have identified plenty of mutations that improve the spike protein's ability to bind to human cells that Omicron doesn't have. Besides this, improvements could be made to other aspects of the virus's life cycle, such as genome replication, as we mentioned above. But let's assume, for a second, that Omicron variant is the variant with maximized spreading ability. Perhaps Omicron won't get any better because it is limited by genetic probability. In the same way that zebras haven't evolved eyes at the back of their heads to avoid predators, it's plausible that SARS-CoV-2 can't pick up the mutations required to reach a theoretical maximum, as those mutations need to occur all at once, and that is just too unlikely to emerge. Even in a scenario where Omicron variant is the best variant at spreading between humans, new variants will emerge to handle the human immune system. After infection with any virus, the immune system adapts by making antibodies that stick to the virus to neutralize it and killer T cells that destroy infected cells. Antibodies are pieces of protein that stick to the specific molecular shape of the virus, and killer T cells recognize infected cells by molecular shape as well. SARS-CoV-2 can therefore evade the immune system by mutating sufficiently that its molecular shape changes beyond the immune system's recognition. That is why Omicron is so apparently successful at infecting people with previous immunity, either from vaccines or infections with other variants of the virus, the mutations that allow the spike to bind to ACE2 cells more strongly also reduce the ability of antibodies to bind to the virus and neutralize it. Pfizer's data suggests that T cells should respond similarly to the Omicron variant as to previous variants, which aligns with the observation that Omicron has a low